I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of September. Donald Trump released a new ad today attacking Hillary Clinton over her basket of deplorables remarks. She said half of his supporters belonged in a basket of deplorables, which included racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, and Islamophobic people. She later expressed regret for those comments, but some advisors are saying this kind of language could help her motivate some, particularly young people, to go to the polls. A top aide to Clinton said the campaign could have handled the news about her pneumonia better. David Axelrod said, although Clinton's pneumonia could be treated with antibiotics, an unhealthy penchant for privacy that repeatedly creates unnecessary problems could not. Today, Donald Trump said that he will release his medical records, saying he plans to release very, very specific numbers from a physical he had done last week. And as you heard on the news from NPR, Hillary Clinton will be releasing more medical records. There are tight races in battleground states. We'll look at Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Florida. And the president's approval numbers are really quite high, 58%. Does that help Hillary Clinton? A few of the subjects we'll be discussing for all things political this hour, and our guest is Jennifer Piscopo. She's an assistant professor, politics, advisory committee of Latin American and Latino-Latina studies at Occidental College. Her research on representation, gender quotas, and legislative institutions in Latin America has appeared in leading academic journals. She's also co-editor of the book, The Impact of Gender Quotas, and she has extensive research, travel, and speaking experience in Latin America and also in Europe. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. I'm sure we'll have more than a few after the news of the weekend. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hello, Jennifer. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi. Thank you so much for asking me back.
Yeah.
Happy to chat today.
Yeah, we have a lot to talk about. Let's start with Hillary Clinton being diagnosed with pneumonia, a top aide to Clinton saying the campaign could have handled the news about this a bit better. Would you agree? How should it have been handled?
Well, I think the Clinton campaign would have been in a tough spot. From what I understand, she was diagnosed before the weekend. And as we know, there's a longstanding sort of right-wing, right-leaning conspiracy that Clinton is hiding health issues. I think that maps up onto broader conspiracies about her as just being fundamentally untrustworthy and always hiding something. And so I think if the campaign had come out in the beginning and said that she was ill, dialed back on her campaign events, didn't attend the September 11th memorial, I think that would have played enormously badly for them, right? So they chose not to be forthright about it, to hope everything would go well in the course of the weekend, and it didn't. But I think they would have been in a storm of sort of questioning about Hillary's illnesses, whether they had been forthcoming or whether they sort of got caught, as it were, when she stumbled at the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
So between a rock and a hard place for them, I think.
Don't you think most people realize that the campaign, she's not young, Donald Trump is not young, to have the kind of vigorous schedule, unbelievably vigorous schedule, would be trying, I think, for a 30-year-old, that it would be okay to say, I got sick. You know, this has been, people get sick. People get sick. We all get sick at times. I got pneumonia. I'm sending somebody, you know, I'm sending my husband to be there for me. I need to take a couple days rest. Wouldn't that have played better? And because it does feed into this holding things very close to her chest.
You know, you would like to think that most folks would be reasonable. You know, before the campaign even announced that she had a previous diagnosis, I looked at the photos of Clinton at the 9/11 remembrance ceremony. I thought, wow, if I were in a heavy suit surrounded by men a head taller than me and a tight crowd and it was 82 degrees and I were overcome with emotion, because we know the Clinton was quite emotional about 9/11, you know, I might pass out too, right? I think the challenge for the Clinton campaign has been, that she never quite seems to benefit from those assumptions of reasonableness, right? There always is the assumption that there's something more nefarious going on. And so I think you end up with this vicious cycle where the campaign doesn't try the reasonable tact, people don't respond with the benefit of the doubt, and so things escalate in a way that just fuels these conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. Today, Donald Trump said he's going to release his medical records. He's going to release very, very specific numbers from a physical that he had done last week. I wonder if it's from the same doctor who a lot of people thought was a little wacky.
Right, the most fit person who will ever lead the country, right?
Yes.
I don't know what those numbers will be. I think the other aspect of this, I've been talking about in relation to these conspiracies about Clinton hiding something, right? I think the other aspect is it has to do, to me, a lot with gender and the way the Trump campaign has been really using these tropes of masculinity, right? And so we could think back to the famous reference to hand size during the debate, right? And Trump's enamoration with Putin. A lot of that is really bound up in these very traditional ideas of masculinity, that a good leader is brash, he's braggadocio, he takes charge. And so I also think the painting Clinton as sort of frail and unfit has this gendered element to it. It's very much about that you need a tough leader who's strong, who's the healthiest president ever to lead the country. And by painting her in these kind of gendered terms, you know, she's fainting, she's not up for the job, I think that also helps the narrative that the campaign, and I think Trump, wants to tell about who Trump is and why should he be the next leader.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that both of them are too old to be president?
You know, we've had presidents of this age before, and I think that we, 200 years ago, right? If you made it to 68 or 70, that was really miraculous, right? But I think we are all living in a generation where people are living longer, life expectancy has gone up for everyone, our medical care has improved, and we could all probably look in our office spaces, our coworkers, and see people who are leading top jobs and undertaking really punishing schedules well into their 70s, right? Folks aren't retiring anymore largely in 50s or 60s. And so I think that we've had historical examples of older presidents, and we also live in a different time where, thanks to being in a developing country, everyone can have much longer careers.
Mm-hmm. Another big story, of course, of the week were her comments on Friday when she talked about the deplorables. We're going to hear a part of that in a moment. But Donald Trump's response was, I think, well, let's hear it now so that we can see.
Sure.
His response was, I think it's the single biggest mistake of the political season. Here's what Hillary Clinton had to say. And Donald Trump has already started an ad today on these comments about the deplorables.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Wow.
Racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up. He has given voice to their websites that used to only have 11,000 people, now have 11 million. He tweets and retweets. They're offensive, hateful, mean-spirited rhetoric. Now, some of those folks, they are irredeemable, but thankfully they are not America. But the other basket, and I know because I look at this crowd, I see friends from all over America here. I see friends from Florida and Georgia and South Carolina and Texas and as well as, you know, New York and California.
Yeah!
But that other basket of people are people who feel the government has let them down, the economy has let them down, nobody cares about them, nobody worries about what happens to their lives and their futures. And they're just desperate for change. It doesn't really even matter where it comes from. They don't buy everything he says, but he seems to hold out some hope that their lives will be different, that they won't wake up and See their jobs disappear. Lose a kid to heroin. Feel like they're at a dead end. Those are people we have to understand and empathize with as well.
Hillary Clinton, and she was at an LGBT fundraiser making those comments. You're going to hear more about the first part of that speech than the second part, but we thought that we should play all of it. Here is the vice presidential nominee, Donald Trump's nominee, Pence, in a response to what Clinton had to say.
Hillary Clinton's low opinion of the people that support this campaign should be denounced in the strongest possible terms. The truth of the matter is that the men and women who support Donald Trump's campaign are hardworking Americans, farmers, coal miners, teachers, veterans, members of our law enforcement community, members of every class of this country who know that we can make America great again. So let me just say from the bottom of my heart, Hillary, they are not a basket of anything. They are Americans, and they deserve your respect.
There are some who have been writing, Jennifer, that the first of her comments there could be helpful to her campaign, and I'm wondering what you think. Could energize non-whites, liberals, and continue deepening revulsion at Trump among college-educated whites and perhaps even millennials who might be uncertain about her. Do you think that's true?
You know, I think that's an interesting perspective, and I think that it could be true. I think there are perhaps certainly voters on the left and perhaps voters that also tended towards Bernie Sanders who felt that there hasn't been enough focus on the parts of the Trump campaign and some of the actions of Trump and some of the actions of his supporters that really do fit those ists and icks that Clinton mentioned, right? If you go to Trump rallies, you will find T-shirts that say ditch the witch, although they don't use the word
witch,
right? And that's not all of Trump's support. That doesn't mean that everyone at a Trump supporter buys or wears that T-shirt, but I do think there are factions on the left who find that rhetoric very gendered, very sexist, very troubling, who wish that there were stronger pushbacks against Trump for allowing those kinds of attitudes to flourish. So I think that it could work. I certainly think the Republicans feel that this is a gift that's landed in their lap, that she spoke this way. But if you listen to the second part of the speech, right, which you played, and you listen to it with Pence's comments next to each other, you would almost say that Clinton and Pence agree about the second characteristic of Trump supporters and who they are, and Clinton herself expresses empathy for them. So I think the full clip could be energizing for leftist voters, but as you said, the Republicans are just going to play that first half for us.
Yeah, you're not going to hear the second half. There's no doubt about that. And the whole tone of what she had to say, she's been criticized for not being, I don't know what is the right word, human enough. In the second comment, actually in the whole speech, she did present kind of a more heartfelt Hillary Clinton, I think.
I think so, and I think even in the first part, you know, you hear it almost as a throwaway, and then it played well to the crowd, and so she kind of ran with it in a way that was perhaps flippant, but almost casual and unscripted. And of course, that's when candidates get in trouble, but you're right that you are seeing a bit of spontaneity and lightheartedness there in the first part, and then genuine empathy in the second part. I mean, the part about these are voters who feel left behind, left down, nobody worries about them. A really interesting study a few weeks ago about Trump supporters looked at zip codes, and they found that Trump supporters were often not the people doing worse in their zip code, but they lived in zip codes that were doing badly overall in terms of drug addiction, unemployment, those issues. And so part of the idea was that the Trump supporters are not the most beleaguered, but they live in quite beleaguered areas, and they look at the areas where they live, and they see reasons to be hopeless. And I think Clinton really picks up on that in the second part of her speech.
But Barack Obama's approval ratings, there are some people, I'm sure, Democrats who would like to see him run for a third term. He's got a 58% approval rating. We're doing a show on George Bush, that big biography on him tomorrow, and his approval ratings were in the 28% when he left office. This is high approval rating. It can only help Hillary Clinton, can't it, or not?
Well, I think the high approval rating comes, you know, Obama is on his way out, and what we've seen from Obama a lot, I think perhaps especially among Democrats, especially among the left, I think are driving a lot of this approval rating, is now that he's unencumbered, he's taking stronger actions and stronger stances on issues that matter to the left than he did in the previous 7 years. And so I think that's really boosting the approval ratings. To what extent that's tied to the party doing well overall, I think is an interesting question, because both Obama and Clinton have been such strong personalities. They don't have an individualistic brand of politics in the sense that they break with the party in the way that Trump does. I think both Obama and Clinton are Democrats, but I think people's reactions to them are often about who they seem to be as individuals in terms of their characters, and less about who they seem to be as just, you know, interchangeable with any other Democrat leader of the party. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that approval rating for Obama will boost Clinton, because, you know, people respond to their perceptions of her character in a way that's often divorced from the Democratic Party.
Has he been campaigning very much for her, do you know?
I think he has been speaking in support of her, but in terms of going on the trail in a really sustained way, I haven't seen him do that, no.
Would that be helpful to her? Should he be doing that?
I think that's should he do that? I think it would probably galvanize supporters. I don't know if it would have a big effect for middle-of-the-road voters or undecided voters. I think undecided voters really want to know what the political future will look like under Clinton or Trump, and I'm not sure that Obama can assure them of that. Right. So I think that Obama would draw large crowds from the Democratic base. And so maybe folks that might stay home would be energized. But I think they say 2 in 10 or 3 in 10 voters are still undecided. I don't know if Obama is the right one to help them make up their minds.
Well, let's go to phone calls and we'll take them momentarily. It's All Things Political. We're talking about the news of the weekend. You can certainly go beyond that. Hillary Clinton's diagnosis of pneumonia and Donald Trump running an ad about her deplorables statement. We're also going to look more carefully at some poll numbers from some battleground states, and also poll numbers of what people think of Donald Trump's character. What do you think of Hillary Clinton's privacy on this issue over the weekend? Is it part of a pattern to you? Are you worried about this? Are you worried about both candidates' medical records? What kind of information would you like to see when it comes to Clinton and to Trump? We welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter @KDunnShow. Phones are open for you right now, so call us. Let's talk. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. All Things Political. Our guest this hour is Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics, Advisory Committee, Latin American and Latina Studies at Occidental College. We go first to Jan, I believe it is, in Door County. Hi, Jan.
Hi, it's actually Ian.
Oh, it's Ian. I'm sorry. I was reading it wrong on the
screen. Yeah, no worries.
Hi, Ian.
So I'm wondering what your guys' thoughts are in terms of maybe some Democrats and some Bernie supporters, as well as some Hillary supporters, thinking about, you know, did we kind of make the, you know, tough choice here and may have gone with the wrong candidate in terms of wrapping this up on the Democratic side, now that we're seeing things are getting really tight here in almost an unexpected way as well. And I'll take your response off there.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
Okay. So thanks, Ian. You know, you can't go back and try it again with a different candidate, and so I think we'd have to say, what does it mean to go with the wrong candidate? I mean, the Democratic Party went with the candidate that won the most delegates at the convention, and so that is the candidate that you have. And so Bernie Sanders, I think, would be just as likely to face questions about his age. I think Bernie Sanders and his health. I think Bernie Sanders might be just as likely to face some questions about his domestic policies and their implementability. So I think it's hard in retrospect to have that question, and I haven't seen any real chatter among sort of mainstream Democrats sort of regretting that they've put Clinton forward.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Gary in Glendale. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Kathleen and Professor Piscopo. Thank you for getting right on a hot topic. First of all, I think that journalists, analysts, talk show hosts should remind people in the lieu of Hillary's exaggeration, which is really what it was, the tone of the Republican convention, of the Trump convention, how it was filled with hate, very Mussolini-like chants, lock her up, so forth. And it's kind of in the backwash of that that Hillary, I think, just got a little carried away. And when you see people with T-shirts in public places that say anybody but Hillary, and I don't know how many of the other more serious ones around, a little, just a reminder that the backdrop of her comment, her exaggeration, comes from, well, and this thing about Trump calling the president a failure, calling our foreign policy a catastrophe and things like that, totally unfounded comments. Compared to that, her comment breaking the cardinal rule of not attacking voters, it's just really mild. It's more like Obama's guns and God comment in the Pennsylvania primary season 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that really echoes Kathleen's original point about are these comments that in fact might energize part of the base and might energize part of the left. And I think it is true that there are some supporters, and our caller might be one of them, that feel enough has not been done among the media, among voters, among groups that are working on voter mobilization to hold Trump and his supporters account for the more inflammatory and racist and sexist and xenophobic things that are said both by the candidate and by some of his supporters. You know, Trump mocked a disabled person, and there was some chatter about that, but we seem to have forgotten that later, you know, a few months later, that one of our candidates for president of the nation sort of felt it okay to mock someone with a disability. And
right.
I do think there's been a little bit of reluctance to really go after Trump for some of his behavior and his behavior supporters. And I think the Matt Lauer interview really captures that, right? A lot of focus on the emails and a lot of focus on Putin, and really not a lot of accountability for some of these more deplorable statements.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see how the debates are handled now, how all those questions will be, because so many of them are understandably very troublesome to a lot of Americans. There was a Washington Post ABC poll recently that, and there are lots of polls that say this, 60% of Americans believe he's biased, 48% believe that strongly. Among college-educated white women, the number is 61%. The only group that doesn't think that he is prejudiced and biased is white men without a college degree.
Yeah, and one of the most fascinating aspects as someone who studies, of course, gender and politics to watch was the real rallying that happened around Megyn Kelly when she hosted that earlier debate, right? And Megyn Kelly is an incredibly respected reporter, but perhaps usually not an icon of, say, the feminists or the
right.
left, given her role of Fox News. But the real support from women across the spectrum, because she was attacked not for her political views and not for her reporting and not for the network she worked, but really as a woman. And what I think is interesting is if you look at the schedule of debate moderators for the upcoming three presidential debates, there's only one woman listed to moderate these debates, and she's listed as a co-moderator. And I think something that Trump has quite a challenge being challenged. He seems to have a particular challenge being challenged by women, and it's certainly notable both for people who want to see equal representation in journalism and people who think about how the debates might unfold, that there are not a prominent place being given to female journalists in these debates.
Mm. Is it Martha Raddatz is co-anchoring one of the debates?
Correct.
Is she really? She's good. I mean, she knows her foreign policy, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
Gary, thanks so much for your call. Let us go next to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, Mr. Obama definitely shouldn't stump for Hillary. What has he done for the kids in Sherman Park? What has he done for the black kids in Chicago? He didn't even mention the murder rate in Chicago until the last year of his presidency. But all I want to talk about is Hillary's near collapse the other day. Now, this woman is most likely going to be our next president. There's no doubt they're going to force this on us. Doesn't she travel with a doctor? And when somebody collapses like that, heat stroke or whatever it was that made her collapse, why did she go to her daughter's apartment instead of to the nearest hospital? What if she was having a stroke or a heart attack and had passed at her daughter's hospital? This whole thing just seems really strange and hiding something else behind the scenes is the only reason I could think that they would decide first to go to her daughter's apartment instead of really to the hospital or to a doctor's office. It seems unbelievable to me.
Professor Biscopo.
Well, I certainly can't comment on official protocol. I don't know about the official protocol in terms of traveling with medical professionals. But I think the comments, right, really get at this sense that Clinton is hiding something, and that something must be much more serious than it really is. And so let's play it the other way. So she becomes overheated. It's hot out. She's wearing a heavy suit, and she's rushed to the hospital. Right? You could certainly imagine the media fury over unfitness to office if a candidate was rushed to the hospital for an immediate checkup. And I think what it sounds like is that the campaign knew that Clinton wasn't at 100%. We now know that she had been diagnosed with pneumonia a day prior to the event. And so it seems that if you are simply looking for things to blow over quickly because you have just been overcome by heat, retreating to a place to rest and recover to me seems reasonable, but I think we know that when Clinton is involved, reasonableness it doesn't always get attributed to her, and you could certainly imagine the fervor had there been a big rush to the hospital. So again, I think these are split-second decisions that campaign managers and the candidate herself have to make, and they try to play the deck of cards out as best as they can in that minute.
Yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate because the truth is she was sick. If you've had walking pneumonia, I've had it, KP's had it, you're absolutely exhausted. All you want to do is sleep all the time, and here she is at this big event. Just the fact that she knew she had pneumonia and couldn't say, honestly, I have pneumonia, I have to stay home this weekend. You know?
Absolutely, and one thing that might be interesting out of this is to see how this might play with some female voters. You know, I was looking at Twitter this morning, and there were some tweets going around.
Right.
Women go to work all the time,
yeah.
Right? Women still take care of the kids when they're sick, right? And so it obviously there's a political element involved. You're a political candidate. It's a tight race. You can't afford to take time off. You especially can't afford to admit weakness when your opponent is running this kind of hyper-masculine campaign. But I think there was a sense where many women were really empathizing with Clinton, thinking about how many times they themselves have had to go to work when they're sick, and that might not have required standing outside in 82-degree heat, right?
Yeah, interesting. All right, thanks, Ray, very much for your call. Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Good Lord. So now rest at your daughter's apartment is grist for the Clinton grinder's mill. I suppose probably both of you and many people saw Charles Blow's article this morning,
yes,
in the Times, which I thought just said it all. And his point, for those who didn't see it, which I just really supported, the fact that it may not be politically wise for a politician to say certain things doesn't mean she was wrong. Now, perhaps the percentage and perhaps it was impolitic, but he said, if I could just quote two lines from him, he said, quote, Donald Trump is a deplorable candidate, to put it charitably, and anyone who helps him advance his racial, religious, and ethnic bigotry is part of that bigotry, period. Anyone who elevates a sexist is part of that sexism. The same goes for xenophobia. You can't conveniently separate yourself from the detestable part of him because you sense in him the promise of cultural economic advantage. That hair cannot be split. And I thought it was a great quote and worth throwing into the the mix. Anyway, thanks for the show.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you. Jennifer.
I think that really echoes one of the themes that we've been talking about, right, which is, again, that some are really pleased that Clinton has really called out the deplorable nature of Trump and his comments. And I think the other part, really, that Trump has been getting a bit of a free pass on, right, is not just the racist and the xenophobic and the Islamophobic remarks and behavior, but the way that ties into sort of a broader obtuseness from the Trump campaign about domestic and international politics, right? There's a real sort of know-nothingness that Trump brings forward, right? And that all one needs to know, for instance, is that the Mexican government is corrupt and that all Mexicans are, you know, fill in the blank of bad words. And so I think that it ties into the sense of America is not this divisive place where we are filled with hate and dislike of other groups, but it also ties into a real lack of understanding about the elements that would make strong or good domestic and international policy. And I think that's been one of other Trump's weaknesses that has not been brought to the fore as much as it could be.
I want to talk to you because of your special area, and I know you've spent a lot of time in Latin America and also in Europe, Jennifer. I have yet to figure out what the campaign strategy was to meet with the president of Mexico and try to appear presidential. I'm not sure why the president of Mexico thought it was a good idea to meet with Donald Trump. But then to go to Arizona and give that incredibly fiery speech that he gave in the same day, was that calculated, do you think? Why did he do that?
You know, it really baffled all of us who consider ourselves experts in these matters. The current Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, is really embattled. He's extremely embattled. He has very low approval ratings. His government has been beset by corruption scandals, scandals of insecurity, so people being upset about crime and the drug wars. And so the understanding is that there were, you know, a split camp in the Mexican cabinet, with some of Peña Nieto's advisors feeling that meeting with both the presidential candidates, meeting with Trump and Clinton, might give Peña Nieto a chance to rescue his image by insisting to both of the candidates how important trade with Mexico was and how important bilateral relationships were between the two countries. That's the best sort of, you know, way we can understand the president's, the Mexican president's decision. Of course, he invited Trump, he invited Clinton, Clinton declined, and so it looked like this tete-a-tete with Trump, which played horribly badly in Mexico. Trump has an 80% disapproval rating.
Ooh.
In Mexico, right? And then, you know, Trump completely unfazed and not, you know, persuaded by any rhetoric about the importance of bilateral relationships, goes to Arizona and makes this speech and plays especially badly in Mexico, because it means if any attempt from the Mexican president was made to persuade Trump, and of course we don't know what was said in that meeting, right? It wasn't recorded or public, to persuade Trump that he needed to soften his rhetoric about Mexico, it clearly didn't work. So this was a real, I think, political disaster for the Mexican president. But perhaps a real political coup for Trump, right? Because he got the Mexican president to sort of hop to, and he still got to control the narrative about what his policy vision towards Mexico should be.
Right. All right, let's go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Yes, I just wanted to piggyback on that point about whether or not this was going to encourage support for Hillary Clinton, because I was one of those people who this morning decided to make a contribution and then ask where I could get a yard sign, because
really?
I feel the same way as though, yes, she probably was very courageous in going to this event, and you can imagine what would have been said if she hadn't shown up for one of the most important issues that have occurred since 9/11, and I think that she probably deserves some encouragement and consideration for taking that risk instead of deploring her for trying to hide something about her health.
Hmm.
And the fact that your guest said that women have been saying, yes, hey, I go to work, I take care of children when I'm sick, and anyone who's had pneumonia knows how that feels, as though you are a little bit, quite sick, but right. Then you try to dismiss it and say, I can carry on. So anyway, it has led me to make some public support for her.
Hmm. Well, Nancy, what do you think of David Axelrod's comments, and let me quote him, that Clinton's pneumonia could be treated with antibiotics, an unhealthy penchant for privacy that repeatedly creates unnecessary problems could not?
Well, yes, I can see that. I've had pneumonia, and I know it can be treated with antibiotics, but at the same time, you can just feel quite depleted in energy, and you decide that if something is important to do, you carry on anyway. But I'm not sure that she's actually hiding something, but considering the number of attacks and how the other side seems to be capable of coming up with anything negative about her, I support her.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. A yard sign, Jennifer, as a result of the weekend, huh?
I'm sure the Clinton campaign would be delighted to hear that, Nancy. I want to pick up, Kathleen, on the Axelrod quote.
Sure.
I think the Axelrod quote, again, it's feeding this narrative that I see in the quote-unquote mainstream media, right, that a major flaw of the Clinton campaign is that their closed-offness to the press, right, and that I think this has been a long-standing story that's told about the Clinton campaign, but the Clintons and Hillary Clinton in particular in the media, that she's closed off with the press, she's guarded, the press doesn't have access. And I think that this is historic, right, and this is longstanding,
right.
And part of it has to do with the way the Clintons and Hillary Clinton has been in the public eye for multiple decades now, and I think the way Clinton can feel at times quite mistreated by the press, right, which then fuels this cycle of withholding and access. I do think it's noted that, you know, the Trump campaign had barred some mainstream media
right.
units
yes,
for access for over a year, right? And I think they just announced today or yesterday that Politico and Washington Post would now get access to the Trump campaign. And it is noticeable to me that we don't see the same kind of language about the Trump's campaign's closed-offness, their privacy, their unwilling to engage with journalists that we see about the Clinton campaign. But the Trump campaign actually barred some press units from following them. So I just wanted to throw that out there for conversation.
Including the Washington Post.
Exactly.
On the other hand, if you do, and let me cite a guy who had a really good relationship with the press, is John McCain, who was very forthcoming, very honest. You know, the press was with him all the time on all his plane trips. We do live in a democracy, and it is the work of the press to be able to ask questions of people. And I don't care if you're Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, that it would make more sense for them to be forthcoming about just about as much as they can. That we welcome that. Otherwise, you do open yourselves up to criticism. And Trump was criticized, maybe not as much as Hillary Clinton, but she's been a politician for much longer, that they both probably deserve criticism for not being very open with the press or for being open with the press that they like, you know, in Donald Trump's case.
Exactly, and I think it can be really challenging for candidates to figure out how to manage these relationships, especially in more recent time where we do live in a world of instantaneous news, right? And we do live in a world where news can quickly go out in the Twitterverse and quickly go out in the Facebook universe,
yes.
And it makes it difficult for campaigns that want to control the message, that want to give access, but also want to avoid falling into gotcha comments, right? Because sometimes the campaigns might not know the story themselves in the instant that it is happening, right? So if Clinton's overcome at a press event, you know, it could be the question of what is this, right? Is this just a fainting spell related to pneumonia? Is this something else? And so I think everyone's renegotiating these relationships as media changes and as we change our expectations about how instantaneously and accurately we should be informed about what's happening inside campaigns.
All Things Political, you're listening to, and we'll take more phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. Jennifer Piscopo is our guest. Professor Piscopo is an assistant professor of politics and advisory committee for the Latin American and Latina Studies at Occidental College. 800-486-8655 is our number. One line is open. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Sandra and Racine, hello.
Oh, hi. Really good comments I'm hearing. You know, Donald Trump has been given a pass for many inappropriate comments. and shouldn't be so. But if you're not homophobic, sexist, xenophobic, etc., if you're not that, don't worry about it. If you are, I need to hear an explanation of how you verify, what you think of it, why you're thinking that way. What is wrong with you?
You mean from Donald Trump or from people who support him, who Hillary Clinton?
The people who are upset the most, from Donald Trump's supporters and Donald Trump himself, if you're not homophobic, xenophobic, and all the rest, then she wasn't talking about you. Don't worry about it.
Jennifer.
I see your point, right? If the shoe doesn't fit, don't wear it, and it's all good, right? You just don't have to buy that shoe. I think that makes a certain amount of sense. I think when you listen to, Pence's response, I think what you are going to see the Trump campaign and the Republicans attempt to do, right, is not give that interpretation that you just offered us, Sandra, but portray that comment as Clinton's own sort of slagging off of everyone who supports Trump. And I think that matters in a way because this country does have a hard time talking about issues of gender and issues about race and issues about religious acceptance and tolerance and immigration. And so we can often throw words around that you're a racist or you're a sexist as a way to insult or shut down others. And sometimes that label might be warranted, and sometimes that label means we need to have a deeper discussion about what the issues are at stake here. So I think you're going to see Pence and Trump and his campaign try to take Clinton's comment not as an accurate depiction of some supporters, but as her insulting of them, right? And her insulting of all of Trump supporters,
right,
and getting their backs up about that, right? And so I think it's going to be manipulated in these ways.
So it could work to his advantage as well to make sure that his base, some more people will vote for him, either those who find those comments deplorable and say, I'm not that at all, or those who may think that way and want to vote for him because of some of the Twitter comments and comments that he's made along the way here.
Yeah, I think, Sandra's comment, I really like it, right? If the shoe doesn't fit, don't wear it. But I think most people might not have the awareness that the shoe doesn't fit, just to kind of beat that metaphor to death, right? So most people might be outraged that their support for Trump is being characterized as motivated by base feelings of racism or Islamophobia.
Right.
And they might feel that what they see as their legitimate reasons for supporting Trump, perhaps for economic policies, perhaps because they want their communities to improve and they think Trump offers a way forward for that, might feel insulted by being reduced to these baser instincts. And I think that's what Pence's comments are trying to do, to rally the base around that outrage of being called that, right?
Right. Right. Well, I think it might work because a lot of the base is justifiably not doing very well and have been pretty ignored.
I think so. And I think that part of it as well is that they don't want their, and this is the second half of Clinton's comments, right? Part of it is that many Trump supporters would not want their frustrations over being economically left behind, living in zip codes that are deeply affected by the heroin epidemic, to just be boiled down to base feelings of racism, Islamophobia. And they might not have even the self-awareness to really, not self-awareness, that's too strong. They might not, understand the ways in which talking about race or talking about immigration sort of creates scapegoats for problems that are very real, right? So it's very easy to think that your job losses are Mexico's fault and not also the product of changing U.S. policies domestically and not just internationally. So I think that they might not want to be belittled in this way.
Right. Sandra, thanks so much for your call. And our next call is from Mike from Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I'm one of those white blue-collar workers.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to tell you what bothers me.
All right.
Donald Trump is playing hide-and-seek with his taxes. And what bothers me, I've been a blue-collar worker. I actually take pride in paying taxes because I contribute. That's my way of contributing to the United States of America. But I know one thing. I got very frustrated when I found out that Mitt Romney in 2012 paid such a low rate.
Mm-hmm.
And for Donald Trump not to come out and let me know what he's paying, because I got a funny feeling he's paying even a lower rate, There's no way in the world I could ever vote for the man.
Hmm.
If he thinks America is great, then we all should do our part and make it great. We do it all together. And he better not be hiding. If it comes out after the election and it's really low, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to feel really let down, I'll tell you that.
Hmm. Thank you, Mike. It's good to hear your thoughts. Do you think we're going to see a release of his taxes or not?
I think we'll see the medical records before we see the taxes. I think the caller's comments highlight perhaps why the Trump campaign does not want to release the comments, right? Trump has done very well appealing to a lot of blue-collar and or working-class voters, perhaps not Mike, who just phoned in, but others. And I think if the taxes were to reveal that Trump is in a higher class position, meaning he has capital gains, so he's paying less taxes, right, effectively, than, say, somebody whose money is through income, it could really tarnish his image, right? It's almost remarkable how Trump, as one of the wealthiest people in the world, has been able to sell himself, not as an average person, but sell himself as a voice for average people.
It is remarkable.
Right? It is remarkable how he's done that. And I think that the taxes could chip away at that, as our caller suspected. It could harm Trump's ability to say, I really understand your life, which is a message he's able to convey fairly effectively. And I think they're going to hold on until they see an advantage. Right now they see an advantage to releasing the medical records because it will help Clinton look bad, they hope, right? But they don't see an advantage to releasing those tax returns.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Dennis in Montello, hi.
Hi. With all this talk about health, and wondering what would happen if either of the presidential candidates were incapacitated. What would the parties do to substitute someone?
I think that's an excellent question, and I don't know if there is a legal or procedural precedent for that. I suppose if the person were incapacitated in a sense, a permanent sense or a semi-permanent sense, that the campaign could not go forth, the parties would have to present a substitute. But I have to confess to not knowing how the parties would go about that. Mm.
And do you know, this will make all of us scramble to the internet after
yeah.
the show's over, do you know if that's ever happened to a candidate before? I'm trying to think in American history.
To my knowledge, I can't recall a precedent. The parties might have something in their statutes about it. So if you want to go Google, you can go pull up the statutes of the Democratic and the Republican national committees. But I cannot, off the top of my head, name a historical precedent for that.
I can't either. Somebody will remind us of that, but we'll find out after the show, I'm sure. Dennis, thank you very much for the call. Patricia in Salem, hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you, Patricia?
Good.
Good.
It's been interesting. I've been listening to all the comments, and I'm not going to speak to any political agenda per se, but the story or the news about Hillary turning to her daughter when she was ill, I find very refreshing. I find that it shows a human side of her. Who wouldn't want to be with their daughter when they were ill? And I just think that, you know, she's had to have this very strong rhetoric and be forceful and everything. And she's been criticized for that. And now she's criticized for doing this. And I find it kind of charming that, yeah, I'm not going to check into the most expensive New York hospital. I'm going to go stay with my daughter.
Okay, thank you so much for your call, Patricia.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. And Jennifer, on that note, we'll say adios to you and hope that you'll join us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Interesting few months ahead, ma'am.
Yes, thank you. Take care, everyone. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics and on the Advisory Committee for the Latin American and Latino-Latina Studies at Occidental College. She has had widespread research done and travel in Latin America and also in Europe. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, to KP for on-air production, and to all of you for all of your phone calls. We got quite a few in this hour, which is good.